colony collapse disorder describes a phenomenon whereby worker bees have suddenly and inexplicably disappeared from a hive. It has recently been identified as a syndrome following the rapid vanishing of Western honeybee colonies across North America and Europe. Justin Clemens also uses the term to describe aesthetic collapse, whereby poets can only demonstrate their existence as being caught dead, given the fragile conditions of poetry and the inevitable deadly effects of the past. He suggests that poets should be biophanatophiliacs. The attempt, he says, to quote, to continue to write poetry in the consciousness of the impossibility of its continuation, to conjure new kinds of readers from the segmented and administered world of the present. This organic metaphor for the social as well as for the aesthetic figures the individual as having a singular function. The reader, for instance, exists as a kind of perpetual worker bee, while nevertheless being integrally networked to other individuals. In this paper, I want to tweak Clemens' model of the hive and think about how contemporary Australian poetry might continue on, even transform, in the face of a past that continues to contaminate and render the present toxic. In Infidel Poetics, Daniel Tiffany argues that lyric obscurity could be viewed as the ground or medium of a kind of negative sociability. The materiality of language could be said to house a verbal underworld. The privacy effects of the poem is a structure of both lyric and social obscurity that works through generating a common knowledge dependent on expressive and reciprocal correspondences among its solipsistic readers. Poetry might be seen then as a way of activating sleeper cells within the hive, underworlds of activity that may then inform what Foucault calls new relational modes. So I want to pick up on obscurity as craftiness in the way that Michael Farrell suggested in his paper yesterday, or in the sense that Clemens uses the term in his dedication to the Mundiad. That is, as a kind of deceptiveness through aspects of inscrutability, unintelligibility, veiling, secrecy, or coding. And to that we might add Kate Middleton's notion this morning of obliquity. And I also want to pick up on obscurity in light of Robbie Wood's example yesterday of the native trial testimony of Sambo and Whalebone, who completed each other's sentences or added to them, demonstrating a shared knowledge, correspondence, inaccessible or obscure to others, but common to their own Aboriginal kin. Giorgio Agamben argues that the truly contemporary do not allow themselves to be blinded by the lights of the century, and so manage to get a glimpse of the shadows in those lights of their intimate obscurity. Following Nietzsche, he adds that those who truly belong to their time are those who neither perfectly coincide with it nor adjust themselves to its demands. That is, the truly contemporary do not neatly occupy the administrative, segmented world of the hive. Precisely because of an untimeliness or lack of fit, where fit might be associated with fitness and propriety or the proper, a truly contemporary poet may be, to quote Agamben, more capable than others of perceiving and grasping his or her own time. Whereas Clemens calls for a poetry that embraces being caught dead, Agamben looks to resuscitation, or what Pete Minter called for yesterday, a renovation of form. For Agamben, contemporary poetry can cite and make relevant any moment from the past. It can therefore tie together that which it has inexorably divided, recall, re-evoke and revitalise that which has been declared dead. In this paper, I consider both the materials and process employed by a range of Australian poets writing in the new millennium, in the shadow of the totalising forces of late capitalism and the continuing effects of white settler colonialism. I argue that there is a trend towards a playfully linguistic embodiment of the self's temporality, as well as a simultaneous recognition of and frisson with cultural gloom, or what Steve Evans calls a disobedient poetics of determinate negation, as these poets negotiate the past disfiguring Paul. This frisson is perhaps more irritant than mess to overwhelming socio-political structures, but in focusing on obscurity might generate ways of living with the past without co-optation or falling into silence. Clemens' own work in Me and My Trumpet is representative of a kind of playful disobedience, as exemplified in the poem with the title, "We Begin Building That Which Cannot Collapse Because It Will Have to Have Been Built As If It Had Already Fallen." The title acknowledges the paradox of its own existence, the idea of survival being contingent on knowing how it might fall. The poem turns in on itself as second-level parody. Gary was being extremely annoying with the glue gun as a parody buffoon gets stuck to the routine and then can only separate by ripping off his own soles while his kaleidoscopic pantaloons spiral out of control like a flotilla of combi vans. Stuck to a routine, the only alternative is a colourful style that spirals out of empire control, the pantaloons and flotilla becoming almost pantomime buffoonery. Any resistance is already incorporated into a nationalised energy foundation. In another poem, Dispersing Gondwana's Unnatural and Deleterious Radiance, there is a bleakness in aligning social niceties of old ladies with the panicked wattles of an equally decrepit organisation. The literal and metaphorical end of the poem celebrates a musical note of bravado, even if devoid of commitment. Betwixt the sheepish and their dips, the hard white noses whistling with perturbation and dismay, and there clamped to the alien ceiling, an ensemble of species corralling the hyper chaos of time with a song in their arse. Pastoral is acknowledged in the play on sheep dip, but Clemens' sense of white settler culture is in many respects just a ritualistic backdrop in his poetry. The poet and his trumpet blow in light of a scurrilous, hyper chaotic build-up of political and literary traditions, continuing even if nobody laughed, despite me best efforts. In a number of poems, Clemens' work parades its own obscurity. Such as in Blind Spot. Slip id to lop its knob, lost din on lips nil boil, dop sin's lid to sop, slits slop spills to list lost, slip lip blot to top, lob it up, spin bits to bile, sew pot nibs to soil and sob and lop its top. So Blind Spot works through sound and self-conscious suggestive slippage. The material here is the materiality of language itself. The poem cuts down, lops its knob, and gives lip to written history, of nibs to soil. Instead, it suggests a list lost, of blots of a lost din, and the possibility of slits to spill bits. The very title of Brisbane-based Indigenous poet Samuel Wagan Watson's collection, Smoke Encrypted Whispers, foregrounds elements of coding, veiling, and secrecy. Obscurity in both Clemens and Watson's work might be viewed as performative, applying to constructions of history and identity, as well as to language and grammar. In Labelled, and I don't have an overhead of Watson's work, he foregrounds the process of defining and screening for Aboriginality that underpins an abusive, tragic history of social selection. By listing labels of differentiation, full blood, half-breed, half-caste, he lays bare the cultural economy informing the concept of humanity and the absence of universalism or essentialism. Watson is similarly at pains to have the punctuation differentiated with each category, demonstrating how grammar as much as language frames a sense of self. At the intense surveillance of his bloodlines, he ironically suggests that he must be a goddamned pedigree of some sort. Becoming hoarse, he emphasises absurdity and a parodic refusal of such discourse. Let me out of here. I'm a winner. I have a cup to win. Mr. Watson, you're not a racehorse. You're a human being. Contrasting font style heightens the difference between Watson and the doctors, who occupy traditionally a position of rational authority. However, their dramatised sparring could be said to create an equivalence or argument between the two speaking positions, and the poem goes further in being ultimately framed by Watson's, the poet speaker's voice, and his querying the charge of humanity. Oh yeah? Becoming animal enables Watson to borrow from another history that has been used to shape the national psyche, with his allusion to the winner status of Australia's almost mythic racing champion, Farlap. In a number of poems, Watson uses the metaphor of the road, traditionally a trope of life's journey in the Western tradition, as a means of thinking about the relationship of the past to the present. In We're Not Trucking Around, he plays on We're Not Fucking Around, the colloquial phrase for being serious. This stages an alternative glib attitude to the refinement suggested by the opening line, upon the dining table of the invader. The sense of propriety, along with its attendant association of property, suggested by the capitalised term invader, sits in contrast to the lack of capitalisation in the poem's title. In the poem, the country is served up as a consumable platter, or alternatively, as a ready canvas for lyric innovation. There were those who thought they could simply mimic creation and plough through this land, inventive but blindfolded. Where'd you get your license? What's interesting here is that lyric is both settlement and inventive. That is, it is not innately conservative in impulse. Indeed, it may have deployed a kind of bush mechanics, but is unthinking in how it appropriates the ready-made materials of the land. Lyric prosody, as a kind of bad driving, is undercut by the sudden invective, where'd you get your license? An in-your-face interrogation of poetic license as a kind of providential right. This is aligned with colonial violence more broadly, as the white man's road ploughs through and thus destroys the sacred initiation sites for Aboriginal men. In doing so, the bitumen vine, an image that paradoxically draws together the natural and the manufactured, knocked our phone off the hook forever, leaving the Aboriginal community in a state of negative sociability, isolated, literally cut off from communicating across generations and clans. I think that's really interesting in light of references to antennas, TV and radio, the idea of a reading machine. What if we can't pick up those correspondences anymore? So there's always that sense that the possibility that those correspondences might not be made. Forced to stand out on the shoulder of the road, the Indigenous are left feeling a kinship with the discarded and shredded, the black pieces of truck tyre. At the same time, they're not really lusting after the future that the road promises, that 18-wheeler of a lifestyle driving into the next millennium, even as they will have to be looking for a lift. While the colonial spirit is one of Leadfoot's accelerating into the future, Watson forecasts a storm or white squall, an encroaching Absalom before us all, an electronic highway. The internet, Watson suggests, will function even more on speed and on catastrophic ploughing aside of what of that which is already there. Absalom himself was caught in an oak tree while riding beneath it, and this accident waiting to happen is transposed to the white noise of a merciless digital stream. A separation between the disenfranchised and those on the road is emphasised by a continuing you and we. Yet this has collapsed in the face of the next wave of invasion affecting us all. The sense of the culturally expendable can be found in another of his poems, For the Wake and Skeleton Dance. The Dreamtime Dostoevsky's murmur of a recession in the spirit world. They say the night creatures are feeling the pinch of growing disbelief and Western rationality. Dostoevsky has been viewed as the voice of the anonymous, the underground man, and the exile. He also figures the crisis of belief, both of the self and spirituality. Combining the Western realist tradition with the indigenous imaginary, Watson's Dreamtime Dostoevsky is the figure of the contemporary dispossessed. The difference between the phantasmatic and the real is blurred through the abject apparition of black dingoes whose ectoplasm lies on the sidewalk in a cocktail of vomit and swill. They are night creatures, and very much, hopefully, you're getting the sense of that notion of an underworld and its obscurity. Their transient wilderness is not embraced as a positive value, even as it contrasts with the culturally contained and tamed, the dwindling souls fenced in by assimilation. As in We're Not Trucking Around, colonialism is understood through Christian allegory with its apocalyptic narrative. The covenant brought by the tall leviathans of two centuries ago is a pathology of decimation rather than promise, infecting the dream time with the ghosts of a million lost entities. In the modern era, they are merely faces in the crowds at the festival of the dead. As Christopher Nealon argues, late capitalism might be seen as moving extensively through globalisation and intensively through the colonisation of political hopes and effective survival. Here, the individualism of the Dreamtime Dostoevsky has been permanently retired. What is left is the ambiguous open season on chaos theory. The trope of hunting evoked by the phrase open season recalls Watson's earlier declaration that it's payback time for the fratricide troopers. Yet chaos theory suggests that the narrative line of blame is itself a line drawn in the sand. That is, judgment itself might be problematic. Watson's query, is it all worth holding on to these memories amidst the blood-drenched sands, or better to forget, remains unanswered. Whereas Dostoevsky is conjoined with the dream time in Watson's poetry as a wretched shadow, so that notion of cultural merger. That idea of cultural merger is viewed more positively in Michael Farrell's poem, The Influence of Lorca in the Outback. Farrell imagines Western poetic tradition being taken up enthusiastically as a new craze or fad, and I liked his sort of reference to the fanatic in his paper. Among those not commonly thought of as poetry readers, particularly those living rurally. So this sense of, again, correspondences that we don't think of, that a fanaticism of craze. While Watson's poem cites the rhetorical framework of Christianity underpinning colonial destruction, Farrell notes, the outback's too large a temple for a Christ. Foregrounding a transformative wave of literacy and cosmopolitanism sweeping the countryside, Farrell looks beyond the traditional, oversimplified division between city and bush. Within such a paradigm, cultivated readers resided in the metropolis, while those from the country were more likely to listen to acoustic guitar, country and western, or electric rock. As Farrell notes, such divisions are false. Even in the cities, it's known the outback is no monoculture. He discerns that whispers have been heard of resistance, especially by men who find Lorca too feminine. It's said here and there the influence of Rimbaud is beginning to show. Alternatively, others are living more reclusive lives in the style of Dickinson, collecting native flowers, wearing white, and making packets of poetry. Aesthetic fashion itself ignites a debate over taste. Farrell even suggests that the Paris Commune is referred to as a local movement, as the rural working class assume power in selectively adopting and diversifying their own identity. As Agamben contends, fashion divides time according to a no more and a not yet, and holds a particular capacity for contemporaneity. Farrell notes, they go looking for bones to talk to, like Lorca was a character in Hamlet. Of course, it could just be a living analogy, a Kleinemann in attempts at Indigenous and European reconciliation. Through the proliferation and hybridising of aesthetic expression, Farrell explores the horizon of new social relations in spaces felt rigidly territorialised and historically exhausted. Having grown up in rural New South Wales, Farrell spent his adult life in the city. Yet a number of poems focus on the continuing force of childhood, as well as how colonialism still frames present-day Australian ontologies. In Eucalypt Field, he notes that memories can't be counted on to be contained. This is perhaps a nod to Wordsworth's ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood, where Wordsworth declares, "But there's a tree of many one, a single field which I have looked upon. Both of them speak of something that is gone." Michael Clune points out that Wordsworth's couplet represents the classical definition of poetic space. The I, the transcendent subject, is called forth by the definite, redundant particularity of the object, one particular tree in one particular field. Farrell suggests that spatiality in Australian poetry is necessarily informed by a history of settlement. The stories dominating cultural memory may get used to keep the silence in or the developers away. That is, their symbolic violence can still break necks and maintain insularity. Against this, there is a more personal, located history. And when invaders walk out and start shooting, it's only something to tell your grandkids if you live, meet anyone, or manage to hold your family together. The allusion to the stolen generation, the governmental removal of Aboriginal children up to the 1970s, is found in the line, "If you manage to hold your family together," and echoed later in the poem, when she watches the movie where the father kills the man who might pose a threat to his daughter, she wonders if the message is meant to connect with adoptive dads. Racial, sexual, and domestic violence are presented as temporally or physically distant. They become, in a sense, simulacral narratives. A nationwide domestic, why don't we all get counselling and then shut up about it? Our bruised arms. A nation that has difficulty talking about the history of the stolen generation likewise has difficulty talking about domestic violence, even as the force of these violent encounters registers at some level on the collective imaginary. The poem draws a symbolic analogy between trees and the human, depicting trees as having eucalyptic flesh. Farrell notes, "Some people don't see trees but humans and beat their fists against them, walk through the bark like a chip commercial. Trees too become famous sites of cultural mythologies, such as the one that hanged a bushranger. While trees may symbolise promise in their regrowth after fire, they too are subject to artificial transformation, a neatening into a more appropriate plant. Chop that one's head off, says the farmer. Make it a shrub, a better Eden than the old one." Farrell jokes upon the competing interests of farmers and loggers, both of whom would like to clear the land of trees. Violence all round with the loggers. If only, say the loggers, we could poison farmers, then we'd have some progress. Against romanticism, there is a hands-on approach. The stars are falling out of the imaginary way of life. It's a DIY approach. In Farrell's harsh landscape, there are no lyrebirds to attest the useful deaths, nothing to fertilise here, their tree-like bodies buried. That is, the contemporary poet is unable to compost the this past into some useful organic mulch or render it into another soundbite for consumption. As with Watson, Farrell desists the proprieties of grammar, often inserting commas, brackets, or quotation marks unexpectedly to disrupt the habitual flow of reading. The poem ends by focusing on a personal relationship where there is dissimilarity between bush and park, a zone of wildness against cultivation that manifests itself at the level of the bodily. Your limbs, I imagine later against mine, clashing or coalescing, who knows? But the poem closes once more with the distance of a gaze. My room includes treetops. Your window must look onto grass. Okay. In his long poem, An Allegory of Edward Trouble, Duncan Hose investigates the distance between the contemporary self and the origins of its psyche through the Ned Kelly myth. In the Australian legend, Russell Ward lists the characteristics considered archetypally Australian and that have widely been attributed to the 19th century bushranger as including rebelliousness, practicality, improvisation, hard drinking, gambling, and a hatred of officiousness and authority. As Paul de Man discerns, time is the originary constitutive category of allegory. In Renouncing Nostalgia and the Desire to Coincide, allegory establishes its language in the void of this temporal difference. For Hose, there is a desire for identification with Ned Kelly as a national icon of trouble, while at the same time a recognition of the illusory nature of such identification. The poem becomes then a handmade machine for thinking, to quote Hose, that is a craft. With the post-mortem pronouncement, from arse to throat, Edward, you will be totemised and trophied, Hose presents Ned Kelly as an item reducible for collective and aesthetic consumption. Yet even as he becomes museum object and encrusted form, Kelly exhibits no structural body plan. He functions as a mutable tribal fantasy. While the myth operates as a broader cultural hold-all, Hose interrogates the degree to which it informs himself. I'm glad I were you. I'm glad I had your single heart. An uncanny blurring, and this is like that notion of the untimely, occurs throughout the poem as Hose blends elements of the Ned Kelly story with his own private history, such as being Tasmanian and of Scottish descent. My heart mulched and tartan like the golden bogs of Tasmania. He also incorporates symbolically loaded but coded words from his first collection, Rat House, such as crow, duck, and bacon. And lastly, he weaves in his own anxiety of influence, having Edward Trouble write to the early muse of New York school poet Frank O'Hara, Violet Bunny Lang, "Bunny, don't be difficult and don't be dead." Sentimental yet absurd, the line foregrounds the impossibility of a dialogue with the past, a body that is separate and does not write back. Irony is generated here by the knowledge of temporal distance between not only Hose and Kelly, but Hose and O'Hara. Hose's relationship to the past is necessarily different from O'Hara's in 1960s America. Even though America shares a frontier outlaw mythology, there is a very different structure of feeling in its history of independence and autonomy. Hose opens An Allegory of Edward Trouble with a depiction of Kelly's hometown. Benalla was a fairly wild place, kids eating grubs from barked up trees in an unever unending parody of sunny bloody Sydney. The alliterative repetition of unever unending enacts a relationship of similarity and difference between the two words, a hinge-like strategy that also informs parody. This is to be found in the next section, where Hose rejects the expected repetition of the proverbial sunny bloody Sunday for sunny, bloody Sydney. In doing so, he invokes the Sydney or the bush paradigm of Australian literature. Early in the poem, the phrase, "if blood stains the hydrangeas," is introduced, a distortion of colonial poet Henry Lawson's famous line, "if blood stains the wattle," from Freedom on the Wallaby. Significantly, the line has already been lifted and used by an earlier Australian poet, John Forbes, in 1981 in his poem, Ode, inspired by The Last Outlaw, a TV miniseries brought to you by the Australian mining industry. In substituting hydrangeas for wattle, Hose repeats but deviates from Lawson and Forbes, while echoing Michael Farrell's hydrangean childhood from Sprinter. So it becomes a supersaturated phrase, foregrounding the lack of frontier textual space, and also how contemporary experience might best be understood less through now kitsch native images than through domesticated and media technologies. Lawson's cautionary message that violence will occur should Australia not become more egalitarian is brought up against not only Kelly's violence, but also the often unregistered violence of priests and workers like white ants or louse who chew off bits of Australia. It's also brought alongside Forbes' sly critique of Australians watching an Americanised adaptation underwritten by capital from one of the country's most exploitative industries. As cultural myth, Hose suggests that Kelly exists in the Australian psyche as entertainment on a similar pitch as cricket and football. In declaring, the whistle hasn't blown yet someone is calling you bloomin' gorgeous from the grandstand. He foregrounds both a pressing mortality, the whistle hasn't blown yet, and the immortality endowed by fandom. Hose argues, Edward Trouble, son of a farrier and the greatest of gingers, you can't be too cute or too much like the troubadoursy, sparring with the world who watch intensely. Echoing a line in Forbes's Lessons for Younger Poets from his chapbook Troubadour and alluding to the 1960s Polish big beat band who riffed off the concept of the troubadour and who grounded their songs in Polish and Russian folklore, Hose neatly demonstrates the self-fashioning that gives myth its contemporary charge while simultaneously ironising its specular repetition. That is, he stresses how Kelly's heart, as with the troubadoursy, is observed through exterior details and constructed through a rhetoric of reading. In observing the troubadoursy, observing the troubadour tradition, observing Forbes, observing Lawson, or even observing Forbes, observing the troubadour tradition, an allegory of Edward Trouble could be viewed as what Philip Neelan calls a kind of perpetually collapsing second-order allegory that performs and figures the vicissitudes of materiality and its own dissatisfaction or wariness of itself as material. So this notion, going back to Clemens, of the building that won't collapse until it's known how it will fall, there's this sense of always, and then there's been a reference to the idea of jerry-built subjectivities, I think, here. This notion of continually building on endless kind of references that link back to that from the past is one which is, I think, at a distinguishing feature of contemporary poetry. I'll remember it later. So Kelly, as a predecessor for Hose, is wary of a history alive with humbug. He produced a Roll Your Own Life writing as a political corrective. For Hose, the contemporary poet always writes in a state of belatedness, with Constables Webb and Harper, Nicol and Farrell coming like a sequel. For Hose himself, there's a sense of belatedness, but it is in the vein of what Christopher Nealon calls a slightly camp attitude to end times when the idea of end times seems itself outmoded. Thus, when given the question, is it too late to join the military? Is it too late to become Cherry? The answer is an unhesitating yes. Alex McDermott contends that Kelly's writing demonstrates a dynamic or radical orality, and this too is found in Hoser's allegory. McDermott notes that spoken word is often formed according to mnemonic patterns, patterns which shape thought and its telling so as to keep it amenable to oral recurrences. In an oral tradition, the primary vehicle for myth and folklore, thought must come into being in heavily rhythmic, balanced patterns, in repetitions or antitheses, in alliteration and assonances, in epithetic and other formulary expressions, in standard thematic settings. As McDermott discerns, Kelly often takes these elements and puts them into non-standard settings. He also tends to use syntactic and associational logic. As with Kelly's writing, there's an alliterative repetition and logic to Hoser's allegory. As words like crawl and crow are repeated, then echoed assonantly in words like maws, outlawed, blow and scowled. Furthermore, Hose coins imaginative sonorous phrases such as a bit of mange and a bit of marl, plum shit and tit bit, and skull and knack. At one stage, Hose reverts into something, something, something about, self-consciously emphasising poetic rhythm over meaning. How am I going for time? Yep. Okay. What I'll say is that what an allegory does is duck instrumentality and flout a kind of poetic tongue pulling. At once calling for judgment, it associates bad taste or bad decision making with a kind of dumbness that is heartily embraced. The poem therefore puts Kelly in the tradition of the hoon, transforming the romantic landscape that is suggested in the name Mount Panorama into a circuit for speed and bravado performance of masculine self. An allegory also refers to cretin, idiot, and the single brow of the uninvolved. It puts forward the unexpert, the amateur repertory. This tendency aligns it with Clemens' poetry, where the poet speaker spun out doing donuts in the pastor's ute, seven times round the church hall in the country dirt, allegorically discerning naturally despite batty flies and ochreish dust wrapping our pupils like knuckles with the 12-inch rule of Apollo, imperial measure, till day felt a desert in drops of undrinkable dumb height. Even as one rages against or resists ideological enclosure, Hose suggests that this is not available to all. Drag free from the scintillate hooks of desperate requirements of middle age unless you're indigenous, taught, or pissed, or Edward Kullak. An allegory of Edward Trouble presents, as Hose himself points out, an Australian kind of intelligence that is culturally bound, but also post-cynical, self-deprecating, and a proud wearer of its own flaws. I too was a bird lover, though mostly I shot them. By judging the self, O bright cretin, Hose foregrounds the field of judgment as cultural and the presumptions that we bring to it, but in so doing opens up a space for questioning or at the least complication. I'll skip discussion of Fiona's work. And while I've only skimmed over a few moments in their poetry, and I think partly because it is about the subject matter being obscure and the fact that the language and grammar, the very form of it, is obscure and difficult to adequately talk about. Hopefully, though, I've been able to give you a bit of an idea of how some Australian poets are presenting a bleakly absurd but energetically nihilistic sequel to Australian poetry, writing out of the psychical damage of colonialism and late capitalism, while at the same time being aware that they're only going to be themselves an episode within that lineage. As Christopher Nealon suggests, the poems of post-millennium writers seem to be written out of some set of conditions we are still struggling to name, that questions of naming, bad naming, inadequate naming. Examples of the contemporary these poets embody are lyric obscurity that delights in a combination of impotence and defiance, as well as solipsistic inscrutability. In Network Language, Philip Mead notes that poetic language is always heteronomous and impure. In being non-contiguous with, but in rhetorical relation to the world, the contemporary poem might be thought of as being less an example of colony collapse disorder than what Herman Melville termed a hive of subtlety. Seemingly fixed one moment, the next unsettled, it provides infidel dissidence as well as insight into the cultural forces that create, frame, and sanitise subjects under the sign of nation. Thanks.